Welcome to the Smichael Speaks podcast channel. I'm Joanne Smichael, and I'm delighted that you tuned in for relevant leadership learning that will help you continue to soar. Enjoy this episode. I'm privileged again to have Dr. David Dodick as my guest for this podcast on Brain Matters. If you've been listening, will remember that Dr. Dodick is Chief Science Officer and Co-Chair of the Atria Academy of Sciences and Medicine. He's the Chief Medical Officer at Atria Health. He is the Co-Director of the World Federation of Neurology's World Brain Day and Co-Chair of the World Federation of Neurology's Public Awareness and Advocacy Committee. He is the Chair of the American Brain Foundation. Interesting thing about Dr. Dodick is that he founded and directed the headache and concussion programs at Mayo Clinic. He's an affiliate professor at the University of Copenhagen, guest professor at Norwegian University of Science and Technology, and adjunct professor at Thomas Jefferson University, and he's passionate about curing brain disease. Welcome, Dr. Dodick.
Thank you, Joanne. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Today, we're going to talk about living with brain disease, because everybody with a brain disease doesn't die, and there are a whole bunch of people who are living with brain disease, because they're not all fatal, thank goodness. How do people actually survive, thrive, maintain good health, and remain hopeful? I know that's a lot, but we can do it in our time together. Will you share a few survivors' stories? And I'm asking that because I think hearing about survivors is how we build a reservoir of hope.
Yeah, absolutely, Joanne. You know, when you say that, I'm struck by, I see a patient and a family in my mind's eye that comes back to see me every 2 to 3 months. And sometimes I think to myself, I'm not doing as much for this patient as I want to be able to do. And they come back and they said to me once, we come here because when we leave, you fill us with hope and you do not have any idea how important that is for me and my family. So your message of having a reservoir of hope and being able to instill that in our patients is crucial. And I've learned that from my own patients. But, you know, from a survivor story, a couple, I guess, there are many survivor stories I've had because I'm old, Joanne. I've been at this for like 34 years. So fortunately, I have a lot of these stories. But one that resonates is an 18-year-old young woman who was thought initially to have depression that came on rather suddenly and a personality change, and they thought she had a psychiatric condition. She was hospitalized for it, and they couldn't figure out what was going on. She began having seizures, and then the seizures became more frequent, and then she descended into a coma and remained that way for 6 months and nearly died several times because she developed an infection and became septic. And it turned out that her condition was due to an autoimmune condition where she was developing antibodies that were attacking her brain. Mm. And once that was recognized and treatment was started, she awakened. And to make a long story short, she went back and finished graduate school.
That's so fascinating. That's awesome.
Now there's a survivor story, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, oh yeah.
Nobody thought this young woman would ever recover. And she's now a fully functioning member of society, living her best life, and was able to finish college.
That's awesome.
Another one that sticks out to me was a young mother of three who for years was afflicted with frequent weekly episodes of what we call hemiplegic migraine. So as you alluded to earlier, I started the migraine program back at Mayo Clinic in Arizona, and I see a lot of people with migraine. And this young woman would have what we call hemiplegic migraine, which is kind of a rarer subtype of migraine where they lose their ability to speak and they can become paralyzed on one side of the body. And it looks like they're having a stroke, but it's actually a form of migraine. And so you can imagine if you're having these episodes on a weekly basis, that's not compatible with any kind of quality of life. or an ability
No,
to
no,
function,
no, no.
or an ability to look after, your three children. And so, long story short, after a simple cardiac procedure, she no longer has these.
And it was a cardiac
It was a
procedure.
cardiac procedure. Going back to my previous conversation about the importance of, we're all, everything is connected. And of course, the heart is connected to the brain. And so it was a cardiac procedure that actually rid her of these attacks and gave her her life back. And now she's able to care for her family, care for her children, be back at work. And so those are two stories that I think certainly inspired me. I'm sure will inspire your listeners.
And I love that you took us back to the fact that things are connected, and that goes back to your cure one, cure many theme. And I love that you have let us know that there's a big spectrum of diseases. They're not all terminal, and that people can thrive and live with a disease, and that diseases actually can't be cured, but with research, eventually they will be able to. And that's what the American Brain Foundation funds, correct?
Correct, absolutely.
Your organization is directly involved in finding cures. Now, I want to go back to that question and go a little deeper. Are there ways that people can still thrive with a brain disease or a brain disorder, even if there's no cure today?
Oh, absolutely, 100%. And I watched it and seen it every single day for 34 years, seeing patients. While living with a chronic condition can be challenging, and I'm not diminishing or underestimating the challenges that many people face, many people lead fulfilling and meaningful lives, find ways to adapt and thrive despite the absence of a cure. I see it every day, especially with the advances in treatment. But many neurological disorders can be effectively managed now, as I talked about on previous segments, because of those advances in treatment that have led to new medications, new drug therapies and device therapies and other assistive technologies. And these can significantly reduce symptoms, improve function, and improve people's quality of life. And then support systems, family, friends, healthcare professionals, and support groups can be crucial for people. Emotional and functional support can make a huge difference. Adapting one's lifestyle to accommodate the condition, including nutrition, exercise, stress management techniques, hopping in a sauna for 20 minutes, 4 or 5 days a week, and yoga, meditation, biofeedback, relaxation therapy, all of these can maintain physical and mental well-being. I talked about assistive devices, which are advances in technology that can assist people in their daily tasks, whether it's communication, mobility, so that they have greater independence, tremendous advances in those areas. Shifting focus to new activities and creative outlets, going down to take a photography class or going in to take arts and humanities class, what have you, getting new hobbies, that can be incredibly important. Resilience coaching, as part of the preventive neurology program that I'm involved with now, every one of our patients meets with a resilience coach. And while they go in not knowing what resilience necessarily is or how they can be coached to become more resilient, they all leave wanting more. So that can be really important. And then, community involvement and staying connected with social activities that can enhance one's sense of belonging and purpose. Part of the you've heard of these blue zones where people live very long lives.
Yes.
Well, one of the things that's very common in these blue zones is the social connectedness. The communication and connectedness with family members and friends, that is turns out to be pretty important. And then, treatment support and lifestyle management, because many neurological conditions can be influenced by lifestyle, including nutrition, exercise, and stress management, like I said. So, a combination of all of these things can, without question, allow everyone with a neurological condition to lead a more meaningful and productive life. So even in the absence of cures, and I know we all want to cure, but even in the absence of cures, the vast and overwhelming majority of my patients lead meaningful and productive lives.
That's very good to hear. Now, I'm curious, you've talked about collaborative research and that's how we get to cures. Beyond the scientists collaborating with one another, do they collaborate with drug companies? Do they collaborate with device manufacturers? Do they collaborate with actual patients who have or who are dealing with the disease?
So that's a fantastic question. So patient-centered research has now become a real thing here in the United States, and it's becoming a real thing more globally. So I'll give you an example. I was involved in a study for the past 7 years that was funded by the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute, something called PCORI here in the United States. And it was not just essential, but it was mandatory that patients were involved in the design of the study, in the coordination and conduct of the study, and in the steering committee, as well as in the analysis and interpretation of the results and the publication of the results of the study. So patient involvement in research, those with lived experience, is, I think, crucial in moving us forward. I'm involved in another study that's supported by the FDA right now, where we're trying to assess and develop more patient-centered outcomes. Because when you're involved in a research or clinical trial, you have an intervention, whether it's a drug or a device or even a lifestyle modification, and then you have to measure something on the other end. Was your intervention effective? And sometimes we may think we are measuring what's most important, but until we have that patient voice and the patient's telling us what's most important, we may not be measuring that which is most important to patients. So I'm involved in a study right now where we're looking at all of the outcome measures that have historically been used for a particular disease in measuring whether or not a treatment's effective, and designing new outcome measures, but with the input of patients who keep the process honest and who can tell us, you know what? What you have been measuring for the past 20 years is not really what's most important to me as a patient suffering from this condition. So I love that question, Joanne. It's happening today. It's going to continue to happen in the future. It's not happening to the extent that it needs to, or the extent that it should, but like everything else, it's an evolution, but it's starting to happen, which I couldn't be happier to see.
That is wonderful. So one of the opportunities that my listeners might have to get involved in curing one and curing many is volunteering for clinical trials. Do scientists want people to volunteer for clinical trials? Is that something that happens? Is that something that's needed?
Oh my goodness, Joanne. I can't tell you how desperately it's needed. And I'll give you an example that's very fresh in my mind. So I happen to be the national co-principal investigator on a study that involves 26 centers across the United States. And we're looking at an intervention in a particular disease that we hope can have a potentially profound effect on this disease.
Can you tell us what the disease is?
Well, the disease is migraine.
Okay.
And I can tell you that at the rate at which we're enrolling patients into this clinical trial, we will be done by 2054.
That's a long time, David.
That's a long time. And when there are 54 million people with migraine in the United States, there's no question that we should be able to enroll that clinical trial in rapid order, right? In less than a year, we should be able to enroll that clinical trial because there are plenty of people out there who would want to avail themselves of this opportunity. But we've got 54 million people out there who don't know that this study is happening. And we've got clinicians across the country who don't know that the study is even happening. Or it's not top of mind for them because they have to get through their day. They're seeing patients. They have a waiting room full of patients. They're trying to help patients, and not always is research top of mind in their practice. They're trying to get through their day and help as many people as possible. And so a problem right now, and one that we've been talking about at the American Brain Foundation, is to have a warehouse, if you will, or a clearinghouse where people can go to. You can go to clinicaltrials.gov right now if you're a member of society, and go on clinicaltrial.gov, because every clinical trial in the United States right now has to register with this government site called clinicaltrials.gov. And it, let's say you have epilepsy. You can go in there and type in epilepsy and see all the clinical trials that are happening now across the country with epilepsy. The problem is it's not as user-friendly or as navigable as potentially many people would find desirable. Mm-hmm. And so there is a need right now for people with a neurological condition, or for any condition for that matter, to be able to go to a place where they're able to see, aha, for my particular condition, there are these trials, this description of the trial. I know who the investigators are. I know what number to call to get involved. So we've been talking about developing such a platform for patients because one does not exist yet. Mm-hmm. So it makes it challenging for people with a condition to know where to turn to. They can go to clinicaltrials.gov. They can look up the website of a reputable institution in the country, whether it's Johns Hopkins or Harvard or Yale or Stanford or Mayo Clinic, to see what's happening there in research. But it's a lot of investigative work for an individual to find out what's happening, where it's happening, and whether or not they're eligible or a candidate for the trial. Right now, the best we have is clinicaltrials.gov. But if you have a particular condition, let's say Parkinson's disease, for example, well, there are organizations like the American Brain Foundation, like the Michael J. Fox Foundation, who are obviously interested in research that in Parkinson's disease. So you can actually pick up the phone or email a contact at one of those organizations and speak to people there about what's happening in research around Parkinson's disease. And can you help me, guide me, point me in the right direction where I can speak to someone involved in a clinical trial for which I may be eligible?
Okay. So
there's help out there. You have to find it, and you have to go to organizations who know what's happening and can point you in the right direction.
That is an important, I like to say, budget neutral way that people can get involved,
yeah,
that they can really be a part of curing one and curing many. And it's clinicaltrials.gov. Is that correct?
Yes.
Clinicaltrials.
Clinicaltrials.gov.
Okay. Excellent. That's excellent information. Are there other ways that my listeners can get involved with American Brain Foundation? Are there other ways that they can become advocates? What can people do?
Yeah, our most important strategic partner at the American Brain Foundation and the organization that gave birth to the American Brain Foundation is the American Academy of Neurology. They are the largest professional organization of neurologists and neuroscientists in the world, with over 40,000 members. And they have advocacy initiatives called Neurology on the Hill, where mm-hmm. they go to Capitol Hill to advocate for practitioners of neurology and also for patients with neurological diseases. So understanding what the American Academy of Neurology is doing in the world of advocacy, I think, is important. So they could get involved there. The American Academy of Neurology has a publication that goes out to millions of people who are interested in brain health and in neurological diseases. And so,
is that Brain and Life? Is that what that is? Brain and Life.
Taking advantage, because oftentimes there's information in Brain and Life where people can get involved. There are opportunities that are published in Brain and Life where people can get involved, get inspired. Perhaps there's a story on a clinical trial that may be in a disease that's relevant to you. or to a family member. And you can reach out and contact leadership members at the, you know, at staff at the American Academy of Neurology to find out more. So a good place to go would be the American Brain Foundation and the American Academy of Neurology, because we're housed, as you know, in the same headquarters there in Minneapolis.
Right.
That would be a good place to go, because there's not too much happening in the world of neurology, brain health, and brain disease in the United States today that the American Academy of Neurology and the American Brain Foundation isn't touching or isn't aware of. So that'd be a good place to go.
You know, the thing I like about Brain and Life magazine is we talked earlier about hope, and it always has stories of real people dealing with brain diseases who give you hope.
Absolutely.
Who offer hope. It's not all, you know, theoretical mumbo jumbo. In fact, none of it is theoretical mumbo jumbo or scientific talk. It really is about people
yes.
like you and I who are dealing yeah. with these diseases.
Yeah.
I want to, David.
You know, the other thing, Joanne, if I could just say, I
sure.
forgot to mention this, but monthly, the American Brain Foundation has a webinar.
And I didn't know that.
And we invite members of the public, and we invite people who have generously supported and donated to the American Brain Foundation, whether it's a dollar or whether it's $1,000, it doesn't matter. And you don't have to donate even to support the American Brain Foundation's research program to attend these.
Mm-hmm.
But I would strongly encourage your listeners to think about attending these American Brain Foundation webinars, because each month I host an expert or experts who are doing cutting edge research across the spectrum of neurological diseases. And so I've hosted people talking about concussion, epilepsy, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, ALS, and the new treatments that are coming out for ALS, deep brain stimulation, focused ultras, you name it. And we bring the best of the best there to give a brief presentation, and then we open it up to the audience, to members of the public, to ask any and all questions they want of these experts. And so now they've made a connection. They know who that expert is. They now know who the American Brain Foundation is. And if they have any interest in pursuing or have a question related to that webinar, they can contact us. And we will give them whatever information that they need. So I would encourage your listeners to think about looking at the webinar schedule for the next year and think about attending them. They're only an hour long. They're 8 p.m. Eastern time. And we sometimes have, you know, I think probably the largest we had was around 2,200 people attending, but it's not uncommon for us to have several hundred people, members of the public, attend. And I think we would have a lot more if people just knew about it.
Mm-hmm. 2,200 people is pretty substantial.
Yeah.
That's pretty substantial. That's great. I want to kind of echo what you just said. I think that the American Brain Foundation webinars would be so interesting to my listeners. So please, I encourage you to do that. You also mentioned something else, that people support the American Brain Foundation with a dollar, with $1,000, with $1,000,000. Wherever you are on that spectrum, I'd like to encourage you to support the work that the American Brain Foundation does. You may not have heard of the American Brain Foundation, but you can find their rating, for those of you who like to look at where you're giving your money, you can find their rating on GuideStar, and that's the organization that gives, what do I want to call it, credence or credibility to nonprofits. It tells you about how they spend their money, all of that. So American Brain Foundation has the highest GuideStar rating possible. And I want to encourage you to participate in clinical trials, to attend the webinars, and to give to the American Brain Foundation. I was looking at the analytics for this podcast channel yesterday, David, and we've got about 28,000 listeners now, literally all around the globe. I almost fainted when I looked at my analytics because,
wow.
Yeah, you know, this podcast channel started as a fluke during the pandemic, thanks to my my great nephew and my great niece. So I'd like to encourage all 28,000 of you to consider getting involved in the work of the American Brain Foundation or in the work of another organization whose research supports brain health, whether directly or indirectly. I am so grateful to you for spending this time with us on what is a snowy Friday morning in Maryland. We've gotten snow, schools are closed, and it looks like you've got a little snow as well.
Yes.
So thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Joanne, it's been my absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed this, and I'll tell you what else I'm really going to enjoy. Working with and collaborating with you over the next several years on behalf of the American Brain Foundation. So thank you for everything you're doing to raise awareness, Joanne, and to have an impact, because your 28,000 listeners, that's incredible. And just think, if each of them gave $3, we would fund a young scientist for 2 years doing work in one of these major brain diseases.
Yeah.
It's less than the cost of a latte.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yep.
So I encourage people to do that. Thanks for devoting your career to this. It makes a difference in my life and in so many other people's lives. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Joanne.
Stay healthy, stay well, and stay on the forefront of this important issue, brain disease. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. I hope you got tools that you'll actually use and share. Subscribe if you haven't already. I add new and relevant leadership learning all of the time. If you haven't visited the Smichel Speaks YouTube channel, check it out. There's all sorts of new content. All of this is virtual leadership learning that will help you soar.